The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet the great Wim Wenders to discuss Pina, his Eintritt into the world of 3D, with a pulsating tribute documentary to the recently deceased German choreographer Pina Bausch. And the rise of Greta Gerwig continues. The American indie actress takes a mainstream turn in her career to star alongside Russell Brand in the comedy Arthur. I'll be talking to Greta about Hollywood and her passion for Fawlty Towers. Zan Brooks joins me to review some of the week's other releases, including a Russian drama, How I Ended This Summer, and Luc Besson is back with the extraordinary adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec. Yes, it's the film podcast with all the right moves. It's Film Weekly.
Pina was so beautiful to watch when she was watching us. In the rehearsals, I often used to look over to see her sitting behind that desk and watching us every day, living every moment with her dances, sometimes like a little child, full of all the feelings that we were having.
Usually the letters 3D are splashed in cartoonish colours with superheroes or talking chipmunks in tow. But suddenly, Art House has stepped into the world of the silly glasses and the three dimensions. And this week sees the release of Wim Wenders' first foray into this brave new world of cinema with Pina 3D, a documentary made with and for the world-renowned choreographer Pina Bausch.
I often thought, Pina sat behind that table and actually watched me for 22 years. And that was even longer than my parents saw me.
The film isn't so much a documentary as a creative recording of the world of movement that marked Bausch out as a brilliant visual force in contemporary dance. As it happens, the polymathic hair Wenders is also showing his own photographs at an exhibition here in London. So I went down to the Haunch of Venison Gallery in Mayfair to talk to the great German director. And I began by asking Wim why the rather modest city of Wuppertal in Germany's industrial area was both a creative home for Bausch, but also the ideal backdrop for his new documentary.
Well, you can't work so, you can't do such a concentrated work and such an intense work in any big city. I mean, no city leaves you alone. Like, Wuppertal left Pina alone and work almost incognito and work hard and month and month and months to develop a new play and finance it. The city of Wuppertal financed dance theater, thereby created, helped creating a whole new art form, because Pina was a true pioneer and she invented something very simple. I still sometimes can't grasp that nobody had this idea that Pina had, how to put dance back on its 2 feet and take it away from ballet and this artificial world of aesthetics to take it back into life and let dance deal with life instead of with aesthetics.
Yeah. I mean, this is amazing. I was never fortunate enough to see a Pina Bausch piece performed live myself, even though I read much about her. Your film, I think, will bring her a whole new audience.
I made the film for people like myself before I encountered Pina and saw her work, because I had nothing to do with dance. I thought dance doesn't interest me, and most of all, it doesn't concern me. And then I've encountered Pina's work, and it concerned me more than anything I'd ever seen. It concerned me physically, emotionally, existentially. It was a language that dealt with all sorts of things and questions of life in a more direct way than the spoken language, than anything, all the other tools I knew. Mm. It was basic and useful and beautiful and healing. It was everything you want something to be.
Yes, or one work of art to be, at least. It seems to me that way too, with the sort of artifice of a camera adding to the what a spectator might see with cuts and different perspectives. I felt I was watching something, amazingly intense pieces from the silent era of movies. It was thrilling for me.
It comes from all sorts of sources. Of course, we had this new language, this 3D, in order to take people closer to it and into the very realm of dances, which is space. And of course, we, with the help of 3D technology, were able to show bodies in a different way. But a person now has a volume in front of you. All of a sudden, a very different presence. The entire history of cinema never had that. Space is always a fiction. Even, I mean, even if you saw the most gorgeously moved camera and films where the camera was on rail, on tracks and in helicopters and flying through the world, it all ended up on a 2D screen and it was flat.
It's something that you've now committed these pieces to film. I don't know if people had filmed her work before, if there was much of it available to any viewers. I mean, we see a bit of archive footage in your film, but it seems now that they're now preserved forever on digital 3D film by Wim Wenders.
Well, these four pieces, at least. I mean, Pina has a body of more than 40 works, so we covered a tiny little bit of it. But the company goes on performing. They, through the film and through the work of the film, they have gained much confidence. They were, of course, shocked with Pina's death. They lost their purpose. They lost their center. And now they're very confident. Right now they're in Brazil, for instance. Next year they're going to be in London during the Olympics, and they're going to do the biggest thing in the 40 years of history of Tanztheater. They're going to perform 10 pieces here at the Sadler's Well and the Barbican in the summer of 2012. So they're very proudly now carry the heritage and this treasure that they have, and that only this orchestra can play, this company.
So. Is their choreography written down like Jerome Robbins' famous West Side Story choreography that no one else can alter? Are their steps entrenched? Are they written down? Is Café Müller, for example, always going to be performed that way, or can someone reinterpret it?
No, it can only be done this way and only by them. Sacre de Panton is the only piece and the only play that Pina ever allowed a different company to do. That was the Paris Opera. They did that. Other than that, her plays are not written down. It can only be done by her dancers, by nobody else, because there's no parts, there's no roles. Pina's unique work was to strip all of that off the dancers and make everybody be radically himself or herself. They are themselves on stage. And that is also so unique. Pina developed her plays through and with her dancers and actors, asking each of them 1,000 questions in the making of the play around a certain subject, and they could not answer with words, only with their bodies, with dance. And Pina dug deeper and deeper and wanted to find the answer that came from the heart of that person and not from any part he wanted to play or anything that he wanted to represent. So her work is also a work of identity, of shaping and finding identity. And in all other forms of theater or dance, you see parts, roles, and not in Pina's work. And that's why it cannot be translated by anybody else.
Yeah. Which, so there is a certain uniqueness. It's interesting you mentioned the Paris Opera, because they too were the subject of an excellent documentary by Fred Wiseman recently, La Danse. I spoke to him about it, and he was at rehearsals for many of the things. You seem to know the intimate workings of Pina's company and process. Were you privileged enough to kind of witness them at work, or did you just see the finished product?
No, I saw them at work quite often. The film I wanted to make with Pina was a film about her look at work. I wanted to see how these very special eyes of Pina, how they were able to see so much and decipher the language of bodies so much, and how she was, out of her gift of observation, was able to create these pieces. And my interest in the film that we would have wanted to make together for 20 years was see this look at work. Pina's interest was that we find together the language to preserve her place. And we found it after long searching in 3D. And I felt that this new language, this new medium, was made to film dance, and that the two were made for each other, and that also dance could bring out the best in 3D that was yet uncovered. And these two interests were not conflicting.
And did she see anything in 3D of her work caught?
Never. She died the week before we were ready to shoot the first big test on her stage with all her dancers. Our trucks were loaded. Pina new 3D only from my words, as my wishful thinking for it, as my high hopes for it. She didn't want to see anything in theaters, and there was not much to show at the point. Avatar was not out yet. It came out long after we had started shooting. And I didn't want Pina to see any animation or any junk stuff. So we agreed that when we were ready, we'd come to Wuppertal. Our trucks were loaded to let her take part in the very first long test for a week. We're going to shoot with her dancers. Pina could have watched it live on a big screen in 3D. And the week, 2 days before that happened, she died.
Oh, wow. It's extremely moving. I mean, many people would have taken that as a sign that maybe her work wasn't to be, kept immortal on screen. Maybe it was something that lived and died with her. One could have taken that as a sign. You must have had some tremendous thinking to do. Do you continue with the project, or do you fade away?
Well, I reacted from my guts and I cancelled it. I called it off. I pulled the plug. Called everybody, we're not making this film anymore, because it was so much based on Pina's presence. And it was her dancers who corrected that, or sort of suggested to me a month later, Vim, we're now rehearsing. We're starting to rehearse the place that Pina selected for the film, and you too. The two of you are responsible. We're now rehearsing these four plays. And Pina, you know what she would have said? She always said, you have to dance.
Danke schön, Wim Wenders. Thanks for coming on Film Weekly.
Pleasure was mine.
Pina is without doubt 3D for grown-ups, so I recommend you catch it in its intended form. And if you want to catch that exhibition of Wim Wenders' photography, a very fine one it is too, just go to his website for information, www.wimwenders.com. And now I'm joined by Zan Brooks in Three Dimensions himself. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, James.
Nice to see you again, Zan. This week we'll have a brief look at Pina by Wim Wenders. We'll look at Luc Besson's new film and The Extraordinary Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec. We'll talk about a Russian film, How I Ended the Summer. And then we'll talk about Arthur. And I'll also fill you in on a bit of motorsport.
Yeah, please do. I look to you for that.
Yeah, I'm the world expert on such things. But we'll start with Pina, because we've heard from Wim Wenders there. Pina, which in Spanish means pineapple as well, so I don't know how they're going to release that in Spain.
Well, it'll be the Pina Express, wouldn't it?
It must be. This was in 3D dance spectacular. I don't know if you're a fan of dance or a fan of 3D.
Well, neither, but put them together and woo mama. I guess the thing with dance is that when you're watching it on the stage, you're watching a sort of beautiful tableau, whereas this goes up on the stage and really sort of puts you in the sweaty kind of animal scrum of it all. And it's still graceful and beautiful, but you do get that physicality that maybe you don't get when you're kind of at one removed watching it.
That's right. I mean, I think when people have done 3D in the past, they always kind of end up throwing a shoe off there or poking a finger at you, or a shark swims towards you to get that thing. And then they haven't quite worked out. Flying is good in 3D.
Flying is good, yeah.
And dancing, as we actually knew from Street Dance 3D, I don't think Wim Wenders had seen that.
But
I don't think so. He's not really. He doesn't know anything about film.
No, he's dropping the ball on this.
But we knew that it worked quite well. I mean, I really liked Street Dance 3D. And it really worked on it. And it'd be absolutely gorgeous, graceful. I've never seen Pina Bausch stuff
Me
before.
Me neither.
But I wish I had.
And you don't see much of her here because she died as Wenders was started making the film. And it's almost like the dancers are her kind of avatars. And that by speaking to the dancers, you find out who she is or was.
I mean, I missed her. I could have liked to have seen a bit of her in
action
herself.
All she was the dance and the choreography. She's a very kind of strange, removed, reticent presence
anyway. I
think she's
more of a spirit than a person anyway, isn't
she? She is. There's a sequel, is The Ghost of the Pineapple.
The Pineapple. Pina by Wim Wenders. Well, we liked it, as you can tell from me talking to Herr Wenders himself. Another European giant returning this week to the big screen is Luc Besson, director of The Fifth Element, director of Leon, the director of Subway. About 5 years after he swore he'd never direct another film again, here he is with The Extraordinary Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec. Set in the Paris of the early 20th century, it stars Louise Bourgoin as a female adventuress. Here she is, discovering a pterodactyl in the park.
C'est pas toi que je parle. En tout cas, tu en as un beau plumage. Sans mentir, si votre plumage se rapporte à votre ravage. Bon.
Louise Bourgoin was a star on French TV. She was a weather girl.
Yeah, I heard that.
A funny weather girl.
Yeah.
And then Luc Besson went, I think you're brilliant and you should be the star of my film. Could she handle it?
She handles it. There's not masses for her to do, apart from being sort of bobbed from one weightless set piece to the next. She wears some fantastic hats.
Hats, very good at hats.
Very good hats. They look like sort of fairy tale Alps, some of those hats, with all these sort of feathers and frills on them. Occasionally gets in the bath, occasionally disguises herself as a fat mustachioed jailer. It's a real ripping yarn, this, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's based on the comic book series of which I'm not familiar with.
No, of course you are, but French people love a comic book.
French people love it.
Tardy is his name.
Tardy, Jacques Tardy. It has Mathieu Amalric in it under so much prosthetic makeup that I genuinely wondered which one he was for a little while.
It's because of that French law that means Mathieu Amalric has to be in every film.
Yeah, but in disguise.
I mean, he's probably in many other films.
I thought he was the pterodactyl for a bit.
He might have
been. But he's not. He's the sort of the evil Indiana Jones-esque Nazi. It's very, very stylish. It looks great. It's a kind of art design, designer's dream, this film.
It has a sort of Disney-esque look, though, to Paris.
Yeah, so it's wonderful to look at. I'm not sure if it's going anywhere.
No, I think it doesn't really go anywhere at all. I mean, because there's a whole pterodactyl thing, which we had a clip of. And then that sort of goes by the wayside and becomes a sort of... Then it becomes about revivifying Egyptian mummies.
And saving Adele's sister who fell on her hatpin while playing a game of tennis.
Tennis and is now a sort of...
Cabbage.
Cabbage.
I think that's the medical term, cabbage.
Then the mummies can revive her.
Yeah.
There's odes to Spielberg here because the hatching of the pterodactyl is a shot from Jurassic Park.
Yeah, a bit of Tomb Raider.
There's a lot of Tomb Raider. There's a lot of Raiders of the Lost Ark, as you mentioned before. It was intermittently charming, but also rather pointless.
It's a very difficult balancing act to bring off, isn't it?
Because who's going to see this? Because it seems to me it's for kids.
It's for kids, but I think they'll be bored after a while.
And also it's in French.
And it's in French, but I guess it's done very well in France. It's very much in, you know, if we're dealing in sort of, you know, crass social cultural stereotypes here, it's very French in that it looks beautiful and is a little bit insubstantial. Very whimsical.
Yeah, it is whimsical. The Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec by Luc Besson. So let's move to Russia very briefly for How I Ended the Summer, the film, which was a prize winner at Berlin in 2010 and was a prize winner at the London Film Festival last year, 2010, became the film of the festival. It's a film directed by Alexei Poborecki and stars two men of very different generations isolated in an Arctic research station. Pavel and Sergei there. It's a two-hander, isn't it?
It is a two-hander, and it's you know, hell is other people, or one other person
or,
in this
or
case.
Or moody old Russians.
Yeah, stranded on this island off the north coast of Russia at this sort of rickety meteorological station where the only heat is provided by a sort of leaking isotope beacon. And, you know, there's that old adage that modern drama is about people not talking to each other. And this is a film that's built on lugubrious miscommunication or non-communication. That the younger guy, Pavel, should pass on a bit of news to Sergei, but chooses not to because he's a bit nervous of him, perhaps. And from there, the paranoia builds and builds and builds.
I thought this was a beautiful looking film, and I loved the kind of wasted, kind of old Soviet era station that is falling to bits, and yet is manned. They do it by sort of entry by pen, you know, and it's very Clash of Generations, isn't it? Which I think we like in our Russian movies, or certainly the West likes in its old Russian movies. I think the best Russian movies at the moment are about that Clash of Generations, in the way that Chinese movies are about the clash between the rural and the urban.
Yeah.
We like our Russians to have an old guy who kind of stands for the Soviet values and a new guy who's got his headphones on and wanders around with an iPod and kind of listens to rock music. And I thought that played out very well.
It does, yeah. And they're both very good actors. I think it gets a little bit implausible in terms of, you know, the second half of the film where they're kind of running around and climbing over rocks and things like that. And so it strains a bit then. But it's certainly got a great sense of that bleak northern tundra where they actually went and filmed with this celestial roar of the end of the world where you just hear the howling winds and their only connection to the civilization is this sort of crackle of static over the radio. All of that is very good. It's almost like a sort of sci-fi movie. They might as well be two astronauts in a pod.
Yeah, it reminded me of Duncan Jones's Moon slightly, where Sam Rockwell has Kevin Spacey's voice for comfort only. And I liked, the photography I thought was extraordinary, actually. That was perhaps one of the most kind of alluring things about about it. It's very crisp on a big screen. Would you recommend people go and see How I Ended the Summer?
Yeah, I think I would. Obviously, you applaud it as an exercise in maintaining drama and tension with two characters who aren't really speaking to each other. It does lose its way a little bit, but it's still brilliantly managed and properly dramatic and mysterious, and you're never quite sure where it's heading.
And I thought it had sort of almost a lightness of tone compared to the Russian film. I mean, I love the film The Return, which I think is just extraordinary. However, it is a very kind of heavy kind of going film, and you come out like, oh my God, I'm so depressed. Mm. But this one I thought had a kind of more...
It's got almost a kind of Hitchcockian kind of, you know, snap and brio to it as well.
It's like more popular kind of entry.
I can see why it won the sort of best film at LFF.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, the people that organised the LFF, like maybe the head honchos, the Greg Dykes of this world at the BFI, would have rather liked a Danny Boyle film.
Yeah.
But I can see why this one did appeal to many people. How I Ended the Summer by Alexei Poborecki. Zan, we must also mention this week Arthur, which is out. Had its big premiere in London. Russell Brand, Dame Helen Mirren, Jennifer Garner and Greta Gerwig, from whom we shall hear a little bit later. An actress I've admired for some time. But Russell Brand, is he an actor you've admired for some time?
Well, not really, surprisingly enough. I mean, obviously this is the remake of the beloved 1981 original with Dudley Moore.
First of all, is that a good
John
film?
Gielgud. Well, do you know what? I haven't seen it, I think, since the mid-80s. And I remember liking it as a kid.
Yeah.
Don't know if I'd like it so much now.
Yeah, I
But what I recall about it, I mean, you know, here you've got Arthur, who's the sort of the drunken playboy who's ordered to get married, otherwise he loses his inheritance, played by Russell Brand, who on the face of it seems like kind of neat casting. But it's not, in that he's fine playing the sort of feckless, irresponsible stud monkey. But more, from what I remember of it, brought this sort of pathos to the role, in that he was like the little boy who never grew up and is a bit worried about that. Whereas Russell Brand's the sort of the swaggering adolescent who doesn't really want to grow up. There's a sort of problem with audience sympathy.
I totally agree. I mean, I thought Moore really invited your sympathies. He was Cuddly Dudley, for God's sake.
He was, wasn't he?
Well, Russell Brand's one of the least cuddly people I've ever seen. Although he probably gets quite a lot of physical affection in his life. But I don't.
Not from you.
Not from me. He wouldn't. And is he contractually obliged, do you think, to appear in his underpants? Because I think he does it in every film.
Yeah, I guess he is, isn't he?
But it's not even attractive.
Well, you know. There are people who disagree.
Do you think
with
maybe
that.
They are? Arthur, really? No.
No, not at all.
Zan, how are you on motorsport?
Really pretty bad.
Good.
I've got my licence.
Good. I only mention this because there were two motor-based films out this week. One is Fast Five. I say that for our American listeners and the rest of the world. Here in England, it's Fast and Furious Five.
Not as snappy.
It isn't really. Will we confuse it with the Famous Five, do you think? Is that people might wander in expecting to see Julian Dick, Anna, Timmy the dog, and get Vin Diesel, Paul Walker and Jordana Brewster and be completely confused?
Enid Blyton would have heart failure.
Wouldn't she? Guess what happens in Fast and Furious Five?
Do they drive around at terrific speeds, shouting at each other and shooting things?
Yes, they
do.
Amazing. Then they get out of the car, crash it, and then Vin Diesel goes, "Hey, let's go and have a race." And then they steal some more cars.
I like Vin Diesel, and I like the artist formerly known as The Rock, now known as Dwayne Johnson.
Dwayne Johnson, he's in this as well. I think he's a newcomer to the series. I can't remember.
I think he is, yeah.
But they're in Rio this time. That's the other twist on
right.
it. Rio de Janeiro. And then they trash it and they ruin it. It's a film. There's almost nothing to say against it because, I mean, I actually quite enjoy cars and explosions and stuff like that. But they all take it really seriously. No one's like having a laugh. And
well,
I think you only get that.
You know, they're professionals.
The other film out is TT, Closer to the Edge, which you may have seen lots of posters of.
Yes,
it's
about
the Isle of Man TT races.
Right, which again is not something I was ever familiar with
now,
before.
No, I've actually been to the Isle of Man. When I was a sports journalist, I was sent to cover it. I don't know what I'd done to deserve such a thing.
And you got out.
Sent me to the Isle of Man. And I think they were disappointed I came back. I hated the covering it. It was the worst job I've ever had.
How was the Isle of Man?
Horrible. It was vile.
They make films to your listeners from the Isle of Man.
Yes.
Well, they do because it's a big tax break haven, isn't it?
They don't care. You could tell them it's horrible. They say, I don't mind. I've got so much money. I'm just having a bath in my pounds. And they made a film about the Isle of Man in 3D as well, no less, which should be quite good. Bikes kind of careering around the track. People dying as well. There's always someone who dies during the TT races.
Yeah.
And this film doesn't disappoint. Someone dies there in the middle of it. And you're supposed to go, oh, no. But he drives a bike.
Instead of you're driving like a madman.
Like that bloke in Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man who gets eaten by bears. really, if you're sleeping with the bears, it might happen. If you're careering around a town at 170 miles an hour, you might crash and you might die. So I didn't care about this film, as you may be getting. And I don't think you'll be going to see it either.
I don't think I will.
The makers of it, Cinema NX, I think do quite well. I think they did really well with Me and Orson Welles. They did really well with the Alice Creed film, Disappearance of Alice Creed.
Oh, yeah, they did, yeah.
And this one, they thought, well, I think, you know, give something back to the Isle of Man. And they keep telling me, well, it's not about bikes, you know, it's about life.
It's about the Isle of Man.
And about the Isle of Man, it's about bikes.
It's about bikes, yeah. Could be anywhere, couldn't it, really?
Yeah, it really could. That is TT, Closer to the Edge. Zan, we're going to Cannes soon.
We are, aren't we?
Very exciting. Have you noticed that I've got breaking news? Jude Law is on the jury at Cannes.
He's not going to take any crap, is he?
Is this the jump the shark moment for Cannes? I really think that's kind of it, really. I think we might all go home.
Don't tempt fate. They could still make a few more announcements. Simon Cowell.
Well, he's not busy, is he?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to that. I can see him say, you know what, Charismatic?
Darden
it's
Brothers.
Just not funny.
Zan, so much to look forward to.
See you soon. And for all of Zan's reviews and articles in text and video and 3D, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
My dad is asleep.
But your mum, she wears earplugs, so we don't need to worry about her.
My mum doesn't wear anything anymore.
Naked, sleeping au naturel.
She's dead.
I'm so sorry.
She died last year.
It's really recent, and I made a joke about your dead nude mum. I'm so sorry, Naomi.
No, really, it's okay.
If there's any consolation, my dad is similarly deceased.
I'm so sorry. Was that recent?
No, it was when I was a child, so you've won that round, but...
Point, Naomi.
Well done, you're winning the dead parent game, but you know, it's not too late for me to run home and butcher my mother just to edge into the lead. No, when my dad died when I was a kid, he was, by all accounts, a very sensible, frugal man who didn't drink, didn't smoke, walked everywhere, dropped dead of a heart attack when he was 44. Lesson being, why bother taking care of yourself? Cheers.
I don't think that's the lesson.
It's the lesson I learned.
Cheers.
That's, of course, Russell Brand as Arthur Bach and Greta Gerwig as his love interest Naomi in a scene from Arthur, released this week. Ostensibly, it's a reversioning of the 1981 hit comedy starring Dudley Moore. The film is clearly the most overt step by actress Greta Gerwig into the mainstay of Hollywood stardom, and a surprising one considering Gerwig's background in Mumblecore and her nuanced comic performances in Noah Baumbach's Greenberg alongside Ben Stiller. So with my top hat and cane in hand, I went down to the Hollywood Junket at the Dorchester here in London to catch up with Greta, and I began by asking her if Hollywood came to her or she went to them.
Oh, I auditioned for the part. I auditioned for the part probably a lot of times. I really wanted to be part of it, and I was very excited when I got to be.
Now, you do know that it was Liza Minnelli.
I do. I'm very aware of the fact that Liza Minnelli did the original, and I was glad that this version, it was a reimagining more than a remake, so I wasn't expected to be Liza, because I couldn't be, because she's so fabulous.
But was it a role you knew as a kid growing up? I mean, I did.
No, actually, I didn't. I mean, I wasn't born when the original was out, so I didn't have an experience with it. And I vaguely remembered it from childhood, but I don't think I ever saw it all the way through. But I had fortuitously rented it 1 month before I got a call that they were doing a remake, which felt like it was faded or something.
Yeah, because that's weird that you're in any shop and kind of go, do you know what, I fancy that Dudley Moore thing with John Gielgud and Liza Minnelli. What made you go, oh, I fancy Arthur?
Well, actually, I'd watched a bunch of Dudley Moore movies, and I really liked Cuddly Dudley, even though I guess he hated being called that. And it was sort of, you know, on the list.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's good completism as well. It's interesting that Russell plays Cuddly Dudley, because he's, funnily enough, he's always reminded me more of Peter Cook, who is Dudley Moore's partner. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. You know, I think Russell's... I think Russell's very cuddly, but that he hasn't been playing characters like that. So I think it's nice that he gets to play a character that's kind of very sweet-natured, actually, at heart, because I think that that's kind of close to how Russell is in life. Mm-hmm.
Did you know it was going to be Russell Brand that you were playing opposite? That was always an Arthur project with Russell Brand, and you wanted that girlfriend role.
Right. Yes, I always knew that it was Russell in this part, and I was a huge fan of Russell. I really liked his work, actually, in America. Everyone was introduced to him in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Right. So I loved that, and then I went online and watched everything I could watch of his. And so that was the only person I knew going into it. And Peter Bainham wrote the script, and yes. I love Peter.
Yes, and he'd written Borat as well.
Before. He'd written Borat and Alan Partridge.
Yes.
So
yeah. Oh, you're a bit of a fan of the old British comedy there, Greta.
Yes, I was kind of raised on... I mean, I had it in my house. We didn't have that many VHS tapes, but for some reason we had the complete Fawlty Towers, which then I had every episode memorized. And it was a very weird thing as a kid because I didn't have television. So while other kids were referencing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I was saying things like, they put Basil in the Ratatouille, which didn't make any sense to anyone, which explains why I started play acting, because I didn't have a lot of friends.
No friends. Strangely enough, and this was not a prepared question, because you can say they put Basil in Ratatouille, you must know who Andrew Sachs is then as well.
Yes, I do. I very much do. Yes, I guess I'm sort of an Anglophile on some level.
But did you know the history between Russell Brand and Andrew Sachs himself?
I did. I read all about that. That was quite scandalous. Exciting.
Yeah. And there he is. Kind of. Then it all comes together for you, Gretchen.
It does. It really does. I'm full circle. Now I'm actually in London, and I just want to see John Cleese. I don't know.
Well, maybe you will. Walking in a funny way down the out of the Ministry of Silly Walks, if you're lucky.
Of course.
The other aspect of your career, I think, because this is, I would say, the most mainstream comedy you've done, a big kind of breakthrough for you in a way. I mean, I loved you in Greenberg as well, but that was a very offbeat kind of movie.
Right.
And before that, I was very aware of you as the, if I may call you, the Queen of Mumblecore. Oh. Two appellations in one that I presume you will reject, but
I this is definitely a huge movie for me, and I'm really just so grateful that I've gotten to make so many different kinds of movies in different worlds, and I feel that I have this access to very small films that my friends make in New York, and it's so exciting and invigorating that people just go out and make films, and nobody told them that they could, and nobody gives them very much money, and they do it anyway. And I love being part of things like that. But then I grew up loving movies and cinema and what films are, and a big part of that is Hollywood and studios and studio systems. And I got really excited when I signed my contract for Arthur. They, you sign a contract that has more, you're under contract for more films for the studio. And I was so excited by that. I felt like I was part of old Hollywood, like you're under contract with the studio. It felt very kind of, you know, golden age of Hollywood type.
They're going to manage you now. Yeah. You're not going to be able to say anything.
I know. I love reading old Hollywood books where you know, something would happen, someone would die at an estate, and the first person you would call would be the head of MGM. You wouldn't call the police. No. You'd call the head of MGM because he'd take care of it for you.
The police are in his pocket.
The police are in his pocket, totally. And I love all those kind of corrupt Raymond Chandler stuff, you know, all of that stuff. And I mean, I feel like when I'm in LA and when I don't live there, but when I go there, my favorite thing is that there are actually lots. There are studio lots, and you can go, and there's a fake backdrop and huge sets being moved, and it makes me
golf
feel...
buggy type things.
Yeah, I was actually driven. I was in this movie, No Strings Attached, with Natalie Portman and Ashton Kutcher, and Ashton has his own golf cart, which he drives around on the Paramount lot, which he was driving me in, and I thought, this is just the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me, is I'm being driven in a golf cart by Ashton Kutcher.
Is that sexy when a Hollywood star says, get in my golf cart and have a ride?
Yeah, it is pretty sexy.
I mentioned the mumblecore thing because I wonder, is it different, the step up that you make when you're doing the mumblecore stuff, which I know you worked on with your co-director in Hannah Takes the Stairs, for example, Joe. Mm-hmm. you have a certain style of delivery right. that people kind of get comfy with, and it's almost new in a way. It's kind of new kind of acting delivery right. that was very refreshing, and then you have to step up into the kind of studio thing. Yeah. Are they keeping pace with the indie scene in that they're kind of saying, well, we want you to bring a little bit of that indie sparkle to us, or do you have to kind of bring what you can to a script that's pretty much kind of in the studio style?
I think it's not quite so self-conscious as that. I think there's kind of a whole crop of girls right now that I think are rougher around the edges, I guess, than traditional Hollywood starlets. And I think I kind of fall into that group. And I think...
Who else is in that group of rough-ass girls?
I can't... I don't want to, like, call out other girls as being rough because it makes me... I don't want to... But, you know, they don't have, like, perfect teeth or something. You know, they don't have that kind of sheen on them that I think a lot of... I won't specifically name them, but they're there, and I really like the fact that we're, you know, a little motley crew. Mm-hmm. But I think I never really was aware of what I was doing as different from what anyone else was doing, and I approach things the best I know how every time out, and I'm always just looking for something that feels real and genuine, and I think the most thrilling moments I've had watching films have been when I feel like I'm watching a person and watching a person doing something, and so I'm always sort of aiming for that, and that sounds very simple, but actually it's so exciting when you feel that you're watching a person and you don't know what they're going to do next.
Can you keep that motliness, Greta Gerwig? Are you going to become kind of a Vaseline Liz Taylor and disappear under a world of bling?
No, I think look like I'm a perpetual graduate student for my entire career.
Lovely to have you on Film Weekly. Lovely to meet you here in London. And please God you can meet your comic prince as he wanders down the street.
I know. I'm very excited by that. I've got an eye out for him and Keira Knightley.
Yeah, they're always hanging out outside in the lobby. We'll go and meet him. I'll introduce you.
Excellent.
Thanks to Greta Gerwig, and Arthur is on general release here in the UK from this Friday, the 22nd of April. And that's all for this week. The wonderful music you've been hearing throughout this week's podcast is taken from the excellent soundtrack to Pina 3D, featuring the great Amon Tobin, available to purchase at reputable online outlets. Remember, if you want to read the best film news and reviews and my trailer trash column, grab a copy of this Sunday's Observer. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.